You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Wes Matlock, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks. She had a pet snake. She bought a red guitar and she ate a whole cake.
This episode is brought to you by our patrons, Ari Ashkenazi and Professor of Political Theory in Star Trek, Kathy Ferguson.
You're listening to Mythgreen's podcast. I'm Chris, and with me are...
Oren.
And our new co-host, Wes.
Hey.
Oh, it's all official now.
Yeah, it's all official. We have a new co-host who has been transported from another world, which is actually the war world, real world, and we're in a fantasy world.
Ooh.
Oh, yes.
Wes, how does it feel to be transported against your will into a new fantasy realm?
It's a little scary, but I feel like I might be able to cope. Something tells me that I'm going to succeed. I don't know why, but...
Yeah, what if you get better at all of the things in our fantasy world than we are? Like, that seems to be a standard, right?
Yeah, it really wouldn't be out of place, would it? I think you guys might be looking to me for everything pretty much from here on out.
All right, sounds good. Yeah, so this week we're talking about characters from the real world who are transported into fantasy. This was a question that a listener had sent in asking us about this topic, so now we're doing it.
It's often called portal fantasy, although I think portal fantasy might be like a little bit more specific. So I would kind of expand it just because it's so very similar to any time when you have a character that doesn't necessarily technically change worlds, but it's still kind of a fish out of water. Like, for instance, Harry Potter. You know, technically, the magical world is not a different realm, but it's still... Anytime you have a character that starts... when they don't know the supernatural is real and then they go behind the masquerade and learn that all these magical things exist. I feel like that pretty much plays the same role and has the same properties for the most part.
If it has like a developed, an actual magic world for, you know, like for Harry Potter is a great example, but like, I wouldn't say Madoka Magica is one because Madoka Magica has a masquerade and there's magic, but there's not like a magical world, right? Like the entirety of magic in that setting is magical girls fighting witches, right? There's no magical clubhouse, there's no school for magical girls or anything like that.
Yeah, I think maybe an essential element is that the protagonist or the character that gets, you know, sort of transplanted has to learn how to do normal things. If it's just like, here, I'm going to give you a sword and learn how to fight monsters now, they don't have to relearn, like, what social niceties are or how to, like, get from one place to another, or which is something you see in, for instance, Harry Potter. You don't have to relearn what's normal.
You could also do it in science fiction if you're really determined. The Last Starfighter is a great example.
Oh, man.
Where, like, that's an old movie from the 80s, I think, where, like, the premise, for those of our younger listeners, the premise is that there are these arcade machines that, like, everyone loves, and this one kid who's, like, a super loser because he's a nerd, but he's, like, really good at playing this arcade game. And then, like, this guy comes down from space and is like, surprise, the arcade game was actually, like, a test to see if you were good enough to become a starfighter pilot.
Every kid's dream. So that their arcade games matter.
Right, and that's, like, the origin of that, like, weird nerd fantasy that, like, our video games are actually training us to fight something, right?
So did Tron come after that, then?
Yes.
Okay.
I think so. Now I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm sure I'll get someone. Listeners will correct me.
Fact check us.
Well, we can probably fact check before we put in the podcast notes whether Tron or Starfighter came first.
I'm pretty sure Last Starfighter came first. I think Last Starfighter is just an older movie. But like, so one of the advantages of a portal fantasy, as it's called, is that I think that it's sometimes easier to bring across all the elements of a fantastic world if you have a fish out of water character to describe them to. It's like, you know, because a normal person living in the Harry Potter world isn't, like, going to take all their time to be like, look at this cool chocolate frog. It is both delicious and has healing properties. Like, they're not going to think about that. Like, they already know that.
Yeah.
Right? But like, Harry Potter is like, I'm in this weird infirmary, and there's a magic frog. What is this magic frog deal? And then, like, the nurse is like, oh, you silly Muggleborns. It has magic healing properties. Isn't it wonderful? Ooh. That, I'm pretty sure that's how that scene played out.
Wait, was there actually a scene in Harry Potter where he eats a frog in their, like,
yeah, there's totally a scene where he goes to the infirmary and, like, eats a
frog,
a chocolate frog.
Oh, huh. Really? I do remember that chocolate somehow, like, helped people from recover from dementors.
Yeah, dementor attacks.
Yeah, the chocolate frogs are chocolate frogs are first introduced in, like, the first book when he's on the train and they, like, jump around and then you eat them, which is, you know, it's never really clear how much intelligence they have. I don't know. Then later, when he goes into an infirmary, I think it's only in one of the third, it might be in the third book, and they, like, describe that the chocolate has, like, some kind of low-level healing powers. Which, like, they wouldn't have any reason to do that if he already knew that, because he would have grown up living in this world, right?
Yeah, no. Harry Potter's a really great example. It's an example of how powerful this technique is and how it's done well. He pretty much has everything spelled out for him. He has, like, what happened to his parents, who the big bad is that everybody knows, like, what's normal in the magic world. Just, like, everything is explained to him, and it feels perfectly natural because he actually needs to know. So that's definitely, it just makes explaining your world so much easier, and that way you automatically avoid all of this, like, well, you know, you and I both know conversations. I should say you don't automatically avoid them because I did a critique of the beginning of City of Bones, and there was a fish out of water character, or, you know, the precursor to one, and they were still doing it. But
well, I have a theory about that, actually. I suspect that the reason that happens in City of Bones is that the author didn't want to do the standard, like, okay, here's the fish out of water character, now we explain everything to them, like, because they thought that was maybe a little hokey, and it can be. And so the author tried instead to be like, no, this information will come across in, like, dialogue in an action sequence, because, like, in the first chapter, they get pulled into, like, the eternal supply closet, which, despite being a supply closet, is big enough for them to have, like, a drag-out fight that takes, like, time to run across. But like, you know, the author wanted to bring that across in, like, the dialogue of an action scene. And so that's what my suspicion. And I can understand that desire. Unfortunately, there's no logical reason for the characters to be talking about that stuff there, right?
Yeah, I would say just use it. Just let somebody explain something to something else. It's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, if you're going to do portal fantasy, that's one of its big strengths. You might as well take advantage of it. Oh, I mean, one of its downsides, I think, is that it can feel hokey for, like, the exact reason we're talking about, where it's like, nowadays, it's, like, almost guaranteed that if you read portal fantasy or portal sci-fi, if you're a Last Starfighter fan, this new person from the regular world is going to go into the fantasy world, and they're going to get, like, amazingly good at the fantasy world stuff, and then they're going to, just win and be great. And that just feels kind of silly nowadays. If you're not really careful with how you do it, it's really easy for people to be like, that's just stupid. And of course, it can also have unfortunate, like, problematic consequences if the person is, like, a white person and the fantasy world is clearly, like, an analogy for some non-white culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I kind of wanted to follow up that one of the things that I liked about Harry Potter was that not only is Harry kind of being portaled into this other world, he's not the only one that does that in the story, right? Hermione is an even, like, stronger example of, like, an actual character with really no connection to the magical world going into there and kind of getting to share that experience with Harry and also actually solve some of the problems for him and deal with all the things herself instead of Harry. Just also the thing that kind of helped with credibility, and one of the things that didn't tire me so much when Harry was, like, asking questions and not knowing anything is that he benefits from being in a school environment, which, like, provides a lot of structure and they encourage inquiry, I assume, and so that, like, helped balance it out a lot more, that he can ask all these questions without seeming like, without it getting too, like, repetitive or redundant.
That's true. The school atmosphere does help. For instance, in book 3, when they have to explain, you know, the shapeshifters, basically, of the setting, the Animagus, like, they do it in a classroom setting with a teacher that is explaining it to them. And so that certainly helps. I don't feel like Hermione, she is also from the Muggle world, but I don't remember ever seeing her feel like a fish out of water. Like, she certainly had a fascination with the magical world that came from being an outsider, but I don't think Rowling ever actually used her to be somebody that needed things explained to her. I feel like she just, like, studied so hard. She just knew everything. Like, she didn't,
right, yeah.
Not like Harry Potter. She almost didn't seem like a fish out of water at all.
Which is why, this is one of the reasons why Hermione, despite the fact that we all love Hermione, it's not as easy to just swap Hermione into the main character position as a lot of people would think. Because Hermione is not a fish out of water, because she has, like, done her homework, like, literally. She has learned, like, almost everything about the magical world just by reading it in books. So she doesn't need things explained to her, except for, like, some... I mean, like, you know, she needs, like, their children's nursery rhymes explained to her, because she didn't bother to research those. But for the most part, she knows all of the, like, all of the magical stuff, right? And so if you wanted to swap her in and make her the main character, you would need to make some significant changes in order for that to work properly.
Yeah, the problem is that she wouldn't have as many problems as Harry does. You know, we need to create, like, challenges for her because she's so competent.
Yeah, it's the same reason, I mean, it's the same reason why the Kira in the Dark Crystal, even though she seems like she should be the main character, if she was, the story would be over in 10 minutes because she's just so competent, which is its own problem, right? But I'm off topic. I've fallen through an entirely different portal.
Yeah, we're going to have to... We're going to have to cover the topic another time. But going back to the hokiness of, you know, and the possible white savior syndrome, where you have a character going into a new world and they sort of learn, not only do they, like, get over their fish out of water, but then suddenly they become better. Like, and these people, and the people of the new world have problems that they should have already solved. And there's no reason why the new character should be able to solve it when they couldn't. And... it's not always, you know, it's not always problematic. It just depends on, you know, being fantasy doesn't make it not problematic because it can be like Blue People Avatar, for instance. There's a clear parallel that's happening that makes it seem like they are a Native Americans, even though they're aliens.
Yeah, gee, I can't imagine what it might be. I like, if they were called the Na'vi, I can't imagine why you would think that sounds like Native. Like, just odd to me. I don't know. I don't get it.
Yeah. It's also kind of an issue in, I think, Tron Legacy, where you have... They also do it mostly to a female character, where they have a female character who is portrayed as, like, being in the setting super competent, and this guy just comes in and is a badass and saves her and stuff. And it... it's, and, it, yeah. So it's not always problematic, but it certainly can be. It does, I think, even if it's not problematic, has an air of being contrived. It's a contrivance.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, that's a, so, like, Narnia is kind of an example, even though I would put Narnia in the good category. Narnia is definitely, what I call legacy fiction, where Narnia gets away with stuff that we just wouldn't tolerate in fiction nowadays, because it's older, and, like, we weren't as good at telling stories back then. So it's the idea of a magical world where specifically kids from the real world are, like, go there to be kings and queens is, like, yeah, okay. I could buy that someone in the 1940s would think that was a good idea, you know, whereas nowadays it's like that would be obviously ridiculous, right? It's like that seems like nonsense, which is why The Magicians is terrible. Not the only reason, but certainly one of them.
Magicians is terrible for every reason.
That's true.
Every reason.
Yeah, absolutely.
Every reason.
But like The Magicians definitely tries to do is both like bad Harry Potter fan fiction and bad Narnia fan fiction. And, like, the Narnia part in particular is, like, obvious that this doesn't work anymore. Like, this worked back in the day, like, back when we were just accepted, like, any kind of fantasy story because we didn't have a lot to judge them off of. But nowadays, it's like, no, that's really stupid.
I think that's also worth examining what the difference is between children's literature is and adult literature. The listener who requested this topic asked about portal fantasy or as wish fulfillment. Like, is this just a wish fulfillment tactic so that a normal person can imagine themselves, you know, going to a world and being a badass and saving it? And I thought about that and I feel like it can be. And I think the places where I see it that way the most are for children's literature, where children's stories in general are more wish fulfillment. They have more of it. Kids like it more, I think. Like, if you look at a lot of kids' movies, they have... super competent kids, which is, you know, what you would expect. And so both Harry Potter and Narnia Well, the Narnia books are children's literature, or at least Harry Potter started as children's literature. I don't know if I'm convinced it's children's literature by the end.
No.
But anyway, but so having those ordinary kids that can, you know, turn out to be, in Narnia's case, the kings and queens of the land, just cause. And Harry Potter, it's like, you're a wizard. And I think that Portal Fantasy certainly can perform that function. And it does make a little more sense for children's literature. And that's one of the strongest trends that I see there.
Well, I just think what I like about both of those stories, Chris, is just that, yeah, they do become kings and queens, and Harry is kind of this chosen kid in a way, but they all benefit from like a really strong support network with everything. They don't just show up into these worlds and immediately start dominating them, you know? Which like is, I mean, if we do look like farther back, like bringing up C.S. Lewis and the Chronicles of Narnia sends us farther back to like Edgar Rice Burroughs and his whole like Barsoom stories with, you know, John Carter and the Princess of Mars, where you take some kind of Civil War soldier, drop him on Mars, and he's like, oh, I'm not used to this gravity, and that means I'm suddenly faster and stronger than everything here, and
yeah, sure,
I rule, you know?
Right. I mean, like, that just makes total sense, right? I mean, also, he suffocated within minutes of getting there, but he was stronger and faster than everything that lived there for, like, the minutes he was alive.
Yeah.
I think another kind of, it's not really a pitfall, but it's just sort of a disadvantage, is that even though having a fish-out-of-water character makes it a lot easier to explain your world, I think you have a little bit less world immersion. So, and this is a kind of a beginning versus advanced thing. I feel like if you're starting to write, then that is definitely having the fish-out-of-water character to make things easier to explain is sort of the best way to go. But on the more advanced side, having that perspective of an otherworlder and seeing how they view things directly and how they view things differently can be very interesting and very enriching to the story, and make the narrative more engaging. And you just lose the opportunity to do that if your character is from the real world. Again, it's kind of advanced because being able to do that and also keeping things understandable and also explaining your world can be tricky, but it, when done well, it's great. So you just can't do that, I think, if you have a point of view character that is from the real world.
Yeah, it's also, one of the tricky things is if the world isn't actually that complicated and you have a more genre savvy audience, they can get frustrated with what feels like being slowly spoon fed the setting through their, you know, point of view character. I felt that way when I was watching, Neverwhere. I haven't read the book, but I watched the movie. And I felt that way, where it was like, okay, I get it. Yeah, the world's not actually that complicated, but they're, like, really slowly spoon-feeding it to this main character who comes across as kind of an idiot to me.
Yeah, and that was kind of a disappointment, because I really enjoyed the book and think it's a pretty good example of how this kind of fiction, in the sense that, you know, spoilers ahead, but Richard Mayhew is this main character, and, you know, he's works in an office, he lacks self-confidence, he finds this girl and helps her out, but what happens is he basically, they describe it as like, falls through the cracks of London, and so enters into kind of fantasy London. And what I liked about that is that he's still in London. There's just different things going on. And so, like, it's familiar. The book really portrayed it more as, like, familiar enough to where, like, he can still, like, he still, like, knows generally, like, where he is and what's going on and where he can go. But, like, the people there are different and they do things that he doesn't, like, have any general understanding of. Which is, you know, that's something that he has to, like, navigate in a different type of way. But to get back to the support thing that I said earlier, like, Richard Mayhew's the main character, but he far from dominates the story. Like, thanks to characters in his party like Dor and Hunter and the Marquis, they do most of the heavy lifting, where he, like, grows in his own way. Yeah, I just kind of thought that, like, that kind of, like, it's our world, but, like, different enough made it more believable when he did contribute in big ways.
Well, if I recall correctly, you could even make a strong argument that Mayhew isn't even the main character. He's the point of view character, but he might not be considered the protagonist. And Neil Gaiman is kind of fond of that. He did the same thing in The Ocean at the End of the Lane. I know Chris has issues with that book. But it's the same thing where, like, the boy in the ocean, I don't think he even has a name, in the ocean at the end of the lane is not the main character. The main character is the witch girl. The boy is just the point of view character, which is not a common tactic nowadays, but it's doable. Like, if, you know, it's the old Watson Holmes strategy, right? Like, if you're really, like, talented, you can, or really careful, you can pull it off.
Yeah, I'm honestly not sure that Gaiman does, though. I feel like in order to really do it well, you really have to sort of make your point of view character fade into the background a little more. Like, that person is watching and offering their own perspective, but I feel like in order to properly set expectations, you kind of have to make the central arc about the main character. Not if you have the point of view character as the person who has all of the problems, and then the main character is the one that solves all of them, I don't feel like that sets up a very good dynamic. In that sometimes when you have what's called a supporting protagonist, which is a point of view character who isn't really the main character, I feel like it's too easy to accidentally give them too heavy a role and set expectations that they will do more than they end up doing.
Yeah, that's totally fair. It's one reason why when I see people doing this when I'm editing, I usually discourage it. Because, like, it's not like that it can't be done, it's just that it's very difficult and it goes against a lot of the instincts that writers have nowadays.
Right, and it sounds novel, which makes it attractive to writers.
Yeah.
But there's also conventions connected to just, like, how readers deal with text, too. And if I, like, you know, if I'm reading and I know who the point of view character is, I'm just going to be, like, assuming that this is probably the main person that we're dealing with, right? So there's, like, reader expectations that come into play with these stories as well, which can make them harder.
Right.
Yeah. So if you're having a supporting protagonist, you have to, like, overcome, be able to reset reader expectations about who the main character is, because they're going to expect it to be that point of view character. I do think in Neverwhere, there was enough, you know, the viewpoint character, I found him a little blank.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he definitely was there to sort of just watch the world and watch, frankly, more interesting characters like Dor. But I think he did have his kind of moment to shine enough, so it didn't feel like he was totally neglected, because he got an important spot in the climax.
Well, it's like his kind of like story arc is really like learning to kind of stand up for himself in a way and like be assertive and have some measure of confidence. And so those are a little lower stakes than like what everybody else is dealing with in his group, but still like meaningful enough for somebody to like read and kind of understand. Like, you know, we've all been there where like, you know, you don't feel confident, you don't have anything, but you've got like people that are there to kind of back you up and you get to have your own moment to shine eventually. So yeah, it's a good example of just a blank character who's not the main person doing the main stuff, but still contributing in some way. I don't know, it was more credible than other stories, certainly.
Yeah. Another benefit that we haven't touched on yet is if you are writing a funny story, having a main character from the real world can work excellently as the proverbial straight man.
Rowling uses that.
Right,
Rowling uses that extensively as well.
Mm-hmm. I was actually thinking of Evil Dead as my yes. example, because like Evil Dead like starts like as an actual horror movie and then slowly transitions into just like insane comedy, and the last one, you know, the third one is like
Army of
Darkness is particularly like, you know, you get Bruce Campbell showing up from the real world in this like crazy weird fantasy world where they're talking about deadites and he's like, yeah, I'm just gonna shoot them with a shotgun, whatever. and you know, and it's kind of hilarious, right? So if you want to write a humorous story, that definitely has an advantage there by having a normal person be like, what's all this weird magic stuff? It's kind of funny, you know?
Right. And even the novelty of the Potterverse, Rowling definitely uses Harry to sort of set that off, because he can react to the hopping frogs and he can react to the cards where the wizards disappear and all the paintings, and sort of bring out how interesting and novel the setting is by having a point of view character that is on the same page with the reader.
Also, if you're setting out to something that I was thinking about for an older example of this kind of fiction, if we go to like way back when, oh yeah, and happy St. Patrick's Day gone, but Jonathan Swift is the guy that wrote Gulliver's Travels, and that is just, I mean, it's really biting satire, which is, it's hilarious, like, what he gets up to when he travels to the land of the Lilliputs and the Brobdingnags. And, you know, like, it's almost like, you know, he's doing these things and he comes to his own understanding, but we're seeing, like, just how critical Swift is being of, like, colonial mindsets through satire. And that's accomplished through this type of, like, portal fantasy by going, you know, very much traveling to these completely foreign lands with different people. And so, yeah, in addition to humor, like, you can use it for whatever type of angle or message you might be trying to include in a story and do it in a pretty fun, pretty weird way.
Yeah. I don't know. I thought that book was kind of a modest proposal myself, but, you know, whatever. Boom. Deep cut Jonathan Swift reference for you there.
So, one place that I find it really weird, and it's not a point of view character side character, is in Howl's Moving Castle. Not the movie. They wisely took it out of the movie.
Yeah.
But in the book Howl's Moving Castle, the wizard Howl, you find out like halfway through the book, actually comes from real world Wales.
What?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I know, it's really weird.
Sorry, I've never read the book, and I'm shocked and scandalized.
Okay, so if you've seen the movie, you've got in his castle, there's this portal door.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that with a knob that you could like you can change this sort of rotate this thing that will change what world it goes to. In the book, might have been the black one actually. But it turns out it goes to real world Wales. And then you find out that that's where Howl is from. And he goes and, like, visits people in Wales. And it's just like, and it's really, it's like, you know, halfway through the story when you've already established the world and everything. And it's just super random and it doesn't matter to the plot at all. And it's just like, what is it doing here? Like, it doesn't serve the purpose of this trope at all.
I can tell you what it's for. It's bad. Like, I agree. It doesn't make any sense. But I can tell you why it's there. It's because, Howl is supposed to be, like, you know, really, like, moody and really, like, you know, prone to fits of melancholy. And him being from Wales is supposed to be, like, the core of why he's so sad all the times, because he's from this dark, dreary, boring place, and British writers love to write about Britain that way. I don't know why, they just do. They love to write about Britain like it is, like, the pit of hell.
Or at least that Wales is, right?
It's not just Wales. Like, Terry Pratchett, like, reading what he talks about, the way he talks about Britain in his books that are set in the real world, it's just like, man, he must hate it there. I don't know why. It's just a thing that I've noticed it in other British writers, too. But regardless, like, that's why it's in the story. And it's bad. Like, I agree. It doesn't make sense. There are much easier ways to explain it.
Yeah, there's much easier ways to explain why Howl is so moody, why he's so emo.
Right. That's part of the reason why in the movie that door leads to just, like, kind of a beautiful meadow that feels like what's this about? Like, you know, it's like, why is...
That was part of the romance, I'll have you know.
Was it? Was it now? Because it struck me as really random. I was like, what's up? Why is this beautiful meadow here? That seems kind of random. And then I read the book, like, oh.
Because he's doing things for Sophie. It's a way of building up their romance.
Yeah, if you say so. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, so maybe a few other things that if somebody is interested in writing this that you should avoid doing. We talked about that, like, the epic normal, like the white savior problems. I think just connected to that is anytime you go to a new place, you know, people and characters are going to seek to understand it. And so how that's described or related ought to be done without, you know, completely exotifying wherever they are, whoever they're with, you know. Because without proper context, that might be, you know, especially if your story had somebody return to the world from their adventure and stuff and say, oh yeah, like these people are all like this and they all do this thing when you talk to them this way. You know what I mean? Like, it's really easy.
Planet of the Hats. Yeah. I think is often what it's called when you have, I mean, there's different ways that we can say that this is troublesome, but one way is showing like a race that all has this exactly the same quirk when they don't have enough internal diversity. So they feel really shallow. It also kind of feels like stereotyping, right? Like you're not thinking about anybody as individuals in that world. You're all thinking about them as a stereotype. I feel like cartoonish exaggerations would kind of fall along the same lines, you know? It's like, and I mean, I feel like it's not good world building. It probably becomes problematic if it ever seems like a real race, you know? It's like, you shouldn't have a character that goes in Japan and everybody there is a ninja. Like that... But you also don't want to build a world that has the equivalent of everybody in Japan being a ninja, right?
Well, that's, yeah, like, that's also thinking about, I think, is it becoming a movie now? Shogun by the James Clavell story? Because that's, I mean, that's right up there with just like some, you know, Portuguese white guys showing up in Japan and being like, oh, they're so confined by their, like, you know, culture that they can't possibly solve these problems. So us Europeans can do this.
Okay, okay, all right. I'm going to have to engage disagreement mode. I'm going to have to engage. Okay, so, and it's, okay, granted, it's been a little while since I read Shogun, and the book came into my possession under, like, really weird and creepy circumstances. but when I read it, I really got the implication that the main character is not, again, he's the point of view character, but he doesn't really feel like the main character, because most of what he does is watch as the samurai characters, like, do their thing. He doesn't really participate very much, or at least if I recall correctly, and maybe I'm remembering it wrong. And, like, I'm not saying that Shogun is great in its portrayal of Japanese culture. I don't know if it is. I'm not enough of an expert to say whether or not the Clavell gets it right. But I do think that the agency of the story is almost entirely with the Japanese characters.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And I'm, you know, I'm reminded also of that, what was that movie with Tom Cruise?
Oh, The Last Samurai. Yeah.
Right, like a similar story, but it's still the same kind of idea that, I don't know. My concern is that, like, it requires some white European or American to show up to, like, catalyze these events. It's like that wouldn't happen otherwise.
Well, the I would say the key difference is that at least in Shogun, a huge part of the book is about language barriers that aren't there in The Last Samurai. In The Last Samurai, everyone just speaks English.
Or Tom Cruise miraculously learns some Japanese.
Right. So like, Tom Cruise's character in The Last Samurai is completely unnecessary. He really adds nothing to the story. Whereas, like, you know, at least in Shogun, like, having an outsider allows for the author to do some interesting things with, like, learning a new language and learning new customs. Which, like, Tom Cruise doesn't have to learn any new customs. He's just magically good at sword fighting. You know, like, also.
Actually, sorry to interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
I was just, when you said, like, learning language and stuff, that reminded me of another story that kind of had a good example of the point of view character not necessarily being the main character. For anybody who saw the movie is called 13th Warrior. And that's based on Michael Crichton's book, Eaters of the Dead, which is actually based on the Beowulf, like, epic poem. And the whole point in that story is that you've got this group of, like, 12, you know, like, Danish, Nordic-type people who are going to go help this other place that's kind of plagued by a monster-type thing.
Yeah.
And the 13th member is this guy from... I forget exactly where, but he's not Nordic, and I don't think he's European, but he provides, like, that extra look at, like, I'm removed from them by language, I'm removed by them from culture, but yet I've been, like, sent on this, like, quest with them, and I'm just going to try to, like, figure out, like, what's going on in different ways without taking over the story. I thought it was fun. I'm not a huge fan of Michael Crichton, but I thought Eaters of the Dead was an interesting retelling of a classic story.
All right, well, we are definitely out of time, so that's a good place to bring this to a close, talking about people who eat the dead, I think, is what we were... We've definitely gotten onto that, which, I mean, is fine, really, because if you think about it, we all eat the dead, like, unless you eat things that are alive, in which case you have a problem.
But... And if they're chocolate frogs, we don't really know what's going
on.
Yeah,
we're a little unclear about that. All right, well, thank you all for joining us. Wes, welcome aboard as a full co-host.
Happy to be here.
Those of you at home, if anything we said piqued your interest, you can email us at podcast@mythgreens.com, and eventually we will get around to discussing your question in an episode. Otherwise, we will talk to you next week. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. He was bigger than a whale, and his breath was terrible. He scared the princess when he came around. Tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon could. Offered him some tea, he accepted it graciously. Now he feels
This has been the Mythgreant Podcast. Opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Coulton.